Welcome to Counterpoint. I'm Jonathan Judaikin. On April 23rd, we mark the 400th anniversary of the death of William Shakespeare. To commemorate the moment in 1616, Rhodes College Piers Shakespeare Endowment is hosting a two-day conversation about 1616 on April 21st and 22nd. 1616, it turns out, was a pivot in history. Cervantes, who penned Don Quixote, died. Pocahontas visited London. Galileo debated the nature of the cosmos in Rome. A smallpox epidemic decimated the indigenous population of New England, and the first slaves arrived in the Bermudas. Thomas Christensen, author of 1616, The World in Motion, will start off the proceedings at Rhodes on April 21st at 6 p.m. in Blunt Auditorium. But he's here with us today to tell us how the world changed in 1616. Thomas Christensen, welcome to Counterpoint.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Tom, introducing your book, you say that in 1616, and I'm quoting you here, it is possible to make out intimations of modernity in developing globalism, militarism, imperialism, diasporism, colonialism, rationalism, bureaucratization, urbanization, and individualism. What did you want to show by writing a book that focuses on the year 1616?
Jonathan, historians call the early 17th century the early modern period. And all of those isms that you referenced were really gaining traction at this time and setting the course for the world we know today. But traditionally, there's been a tendency to look at the elements of the early modern world in isolation. For example, people would study Shakespeare, but have a very tenuous grasp of what was going on in the Americas, in Central and West Asia, and in East Asia. But events in all those places were informing Shakespeare's writing. There's a reason why his company called their theater the Globe. It was the beginnings of a global world, and the idea of the globe and globalism was really in the air. So by looking at things in isolation, our understanding of the world can get a little siloed. And by focusing on a single year, it enabled me to take a more global approach. I have not spent my whole career researching this period, so for me personally, this was a process of investigation and discovery. And what I found was this was a time of bold and extravagant gestures, grand gestures, and the period is full of wonderful stories. And I wanted to give a little bit of the flavor of the time by focusing on the stories. And what I discovered as I worked on this project was that the early modern world, the world of 1616, was highly interconnected. And there were many interesting connections and confrontations and trade of both goods and ideas between peoples and places, very distant peoples and places, much more so than is usually acknowledged. So that's really the main theme that of the book and the main thing that struck me as I was working on it.
So if that's your main theme, each of the chapters kind of has a theme that goes with it. What are those?
Well, there are five chapters. The first chapter discusses the economy of the period. It was a silver-based economy based on mainly trade of silver and luxury goods, especially silk. I have a chapter on changing roles of women. I have a chapter on artists looking back to tradition and then also exploring new directions in the visual arts. I have a chapter on science, which wasn't really science yet exactly, but was developing a more scientific attitude to understanding the world. And then I have a chapter that's just about travel and all the great journeys and encounters that happened at this time.
So if that's the arc of the book, let's drill a little bit deeper. Tell us more about global trade in 1616 and specifically the story about how the letters VOC became the first global brand.
As I mentioned, it was really a silver-based economy globally, and about 80%, I think, of the world's silver was coming from mines in Bolivia at Potosí. Some of it came from Mexico and some of it came from other places, but most of it came from this one really rich site. And then it was minted into Spanish dollars, which the model for our American dollars. And then those Spanish dollars were taken on giant vessels called galleons from Acapulco in Mexico to Manila in the Philippines, where they were transferred to smaller vessels, junks, and taken to China and exchanged there for silks and other luxury goods. China actually used these Spanish dollars as their official currency at this time, at the end of the Ming Dynasty. Then they would come back across the Pacific. It was a very difficult, arduous journey, and again land in Acapulco. They would carry these goods across Mexico to Veracruz and from there to Sevilla in Spain for distribution throughout Europe and even into the Muslim world. You asked about the VOC. It's really an interesting development at this time. It stands for Dutch words that mean the Dutch East India Company. VOC is the acronym for those words. And their logo, which was a V with an O and a C over the two bars of the V, became the first global brand, and you would see it all over the world. And this was a real innovation. The Spanish and the Portuguese were the first to get into Asia and the Americas, and their approach was kind of a traditional approach where power came from the king and sort of trickled down through a bureaucracy and through the levels of aristocracy and society. So when they went to these places, what they were looking for was just good stuff and things of value, and then they would take it back and hopefully that would enrich them, and it did for a while. The Dutch got started later, and they had a more sort of far-seeing approach. They looked at the exploitation of these foreign lands not as one-off ventures, but they were looking at a long-term operation, and they wanted to prevent competition between different Dutch ventures. So they created this corporation called the VOC, and it was really the first international corporation, and it did extremely well. The Dutch gave it a monopoly on the Asia trade. It centered its operations in what they called Batavia, which is current-day Jakarta. They gave it extraordinary power. It was given the right to govern territory, to negotiate treaties, and to wage war even. And as I say, it did really well for the Dutch, not so well for others. And it paid its investors an 18% dividend for 200 years before it was disbanded in 1800.
So you give us a bit of a sense of the way in which there's a global interconnected economy, and that at this point, really, the highest commodity goods are all those goods that are coming out of China and out of South Asia. It's spices and porcelain and silk, and how that exchange worked and the ways in which there was a kind of tilting power in play in which the Dutch were now beginning to supersede earlier European powers that were beginning to trade for those things. If that's the global economy, at least in a nutshell, let's start exploring a little bit about the way in which gender roles changed. And the way you frame that is by telling the story of Pocahontas's visit to London in 1616. Tell us this story. And it's a really fascinating story because obviously Disney's helped turn this into a modern myth as well. But tell us the real story and what it says about the larger story that you're telling about 1616.
First of all, it's just one of those really dramatic encounters of very different cultures. Pocahontas Matoaka was the name she was better known by among her own people, the Powhatan people. She was a girl who was a daughter of the Powhatan king, and so the British thought that she was a princess for that reason, but in fact the Powhatans were matrilineal, so she wasn't really, by their estimation, royalty. The English got into this whole rush to exploit the wealth of distant places even later than the Dutch. They saw all this wealth being brought back to Portugal and Spain from Latin America and Asia. They wanted to get in on the action. So a group of investors in London called themselves the Virginia Company. About the only place that was left for them was the Atlantic coast of North America. And it didn't have the obvious wealth that could be very easily exploited. So instead, they decided to set up colonies and try to get income from agricultural ventures like growing tobacco and that sort of thing. And so they established the first successful colony in Jamestown in North America, apart from the Spanish southern parts of North America. The colony was really struggling, and it wasn't really returning anything to the investors. So as a kind of a promotion stunt, they decided to take a young Native American girl and convert her to Christianity, dress her up as an English woman, and bring her to England to show that they were doing good by converting people to Christianity and to what they considered civilization. So they kidnapped her, and then they trained her in the catechism and taught her to dress like an English woman. And a man named John Rolfe married her, and so she was brought to London, where she was treated as a celebrity. And in a really extraordinary moment, she was seated next to King James and Queen Anne at one of the royal masks, all bedecked in English finery. These masks were lavish productions produced by Ben Jonson and Inigo Jones. And at their peak, one of these masks would cost the equivalent of $500,000 to put on, with lots of stage machinery and dancing and drama. And so Pocahontas was seated near the king and queen. When you think of what it must have been like as a girl growing up in the Americas in kind of a green wilderness, more or less, environment, and then suddenly be thrust into this noisy, smelly, bustling London and going to this grand mask, it's just incredible to think about. And even though she was a celebrity, her story is really comes down to us through writings of John Rolfe and John Smith, the guy who either made up or at least greatly embellished the story of how she saved him from being executed. He was a liar, basically. He made up tall tales and was a self-promoter. So her story came down to us through these men. And we really only hear her speak once when she says a few angry words to John Smith when she meets him in London. It kind of underscores how it was considered a virtue for women to be silent, and the history of the time doesn't really come down to us through the women, but rather through the men and through their writings. So Pocahontas was basically used as a promotional tool by the Virginia Company for their own purposes.
It's also, of course, interesting to know that this story, even in the early 17th century, was a myth that was basically used in part to justify the colonial experiments of the English in the Americas. Her story is only one of a lot of really fabulous tales that you tell in the chapter on women, but one of my favorites was the story of Catalina de Arauza, a cross-dressing conquistador who achieved celebrity status as a woman warrior. Tell us about her.
Well, she is an extraordinary character, and she was a real person. She was born in 1592, and she died in 1650. And we have legal documents pertaining to her story. We have eyewitness testimony. So we know that the story of her life is largely factual, but the way it comes down to us mainly is through her autobiography. What's called her autobiography, which she may or may not have written herself or dictated herself to someone else. She became such a legendary figure that it's hard to separate fact and fiction in her story. But what we do know is that she was born to a Basque family. She had several brothers. Her father and her brothers were all in the military. She had several sisters. They all became nuns, except I think the youngest one got married to somebody. So she was put on this nun path, like all her sisters, and sent to a convent, but she did not like that, and you'll see why in a moment. She ran away from the convent, dressed up as a boy, somehow found her way to America. The story is that she was on a ship with one of her uncles who didn't recognize her in her boy disguise, and she stole money from him and jump-shipped in Panama. In any case, she made her way down to Peru. She worked for a little bit as a shopkeeper. She was a brawler, and she became very adept in swordcraft. And one time she was sitting in a theater, and someone was blocking her view, and she killed him with her sword. And she claims in her autobiography to have killed 15 of her countrymen, 15 Spaniards, and, as she said, more Indians than there are numbers. She fought in the Indian Wars in Chile, and in the fighting she was distinguished for her bravery. All this time, of course, in her disguise as a man, nobody knew she was biologically a woman. Because of her bravery in battle, she was promoted to the rank of lieutenant, and so she became famous eventually as the Lieutenant Nun. The story goes that she killed her own brother in Chile in a duel over a woman. She didn't recognize him. It was late at night, so the story goes. And her story is really unusual because she does not hide her romantic preference for women. So she was getting in all these fights. As I say, she's a brawler. And in one of these fights, she was injured and unmasked as biologically a woman. They made her dress up in women's clothes after that for a while, which she must have abhorred. But she became a kind of celebrity as a sort of Amazon warrior. She returned to Europe. She met with the Pope. And the Pope gave her special dispensation to dress as a man. The King of Spain rewarded her for her bravery and gave her an annual pension. But eventually she returned to the Americas and became a mule driver in Mexico, and eventually was found dead on the side of the road with her mules there. So she's an extraordinary story, one that most people who write about her talk about the gender issues in her story, which are hard to overlook. And so it's difficult to get to the facts, as I mentioned. When I was working on this part of my book, I made a big spreadsheet with dates of when, where people said she was and how old she was. And the whole thing was maddening because it was impossible to reconcile. But the basic outlines of the story are true, and she was a really extraordinary character.
If you're just tuning in, I'm Jonathan Judaikin, and you're listening to Counterpoint. I'm speaking with Thomas Christensen about his book 1616, The World in Motion. Christensen will be in Memphis to help commemorate the 400th anniversary of Shakespeare's death at Rhodes College with a free public lecture at 6 p.m. on April 21st, preceding a day-long series of talks culminating with a theater performance on April 22nd focused around the last days of Shakespeare's life. Tom, you also tell the story of Nur Jahan, who ruled the Mughal Empire in India in the stead of her alcoholic and opium-addicted husband, Jahangir. But you also point out how Jahangir was a great patron of the visual arts and how the artists he employed in his court were influenced not only by Persian but also by Western art. So tell us about this couple, Nur Jahan and Jahangir, who were at the center of the powerful Islamic empire that ruled large parts of what is today India in 1616.
Well, this is another interesting woman, and Jahangir is an interesting character too. They ruled together, but Nur Jahan did do a lot of the practical work of ruling. Jahangir was sort of an aesthete, and he was very interested in, as you said, the visual arts. He kept a workshop of artists, and interestingly, it was a very ecumenical court. Not all of the artists by any means were Muslim. Many of them were Hindu. He was very receptive to Western art, and he was constantly asking ambassadors to his court to send him pictures of the Madonna and Child and other kinds of Western art. In fact, the cover of my book 1616 is a depiction of Jahangir shooting an arrow through the mouth of the decapitated head of a guy named Malik Ambar. And this was painted by an artist named Abul Hassan. Malik Ambar was an African slave who was taken to India, eventually became freed, and became the prime minister of a sultanate in the Deccan region, the high central plateau in India. And he became a sort of a thorn in the side of Jahangir, who was never able really to conquer him. So the court, as I say, was ecumenical. It was very cosmopolitan, really, or at least parts of India were, and certainly the royal court. When Vasco da Gama landed in India, he was a little worried about what kind of reception he would get there. So he sent a convict who was on board ashore to sort of test the waters. And when this guy came on shore, the Indian people that he met there said, "Oh, you seem to be from the Iberian Peninsula. You must be Portuguese or Spanish." turned out they had North African people there who were able to translate from Castilian and Italian. So it was a more cosmopolitan world than we realized, even before the maritime globalism, which really accelerated that. So Nur Jahan was probably the most powerful woman in the world in 1616. She had coins minted in her name. She collected tariffs. She owned a line of ships that sailed to Mecca. And she effectively did a lot of the ruling of Mughal India. And she did it all from behind a screen because of the practice of parda, which prevented women from participating with groups of men. So ambassadors and others would go to Jahangir, and they would hear this voice whispering from behind a screen telling him how to respond, and that was Nur Jahan. She was a woman of the harem, of the zanana. Jahangir had about 1,000 women in his harem. No men were allowed in, or few men. Some husbands and fathers occasionally were allowed in as a favor. The harem was guarded by women armed with daggers and bows and arrows, and they had eunuch attendants. And Jahangir met her there. The legend goes that he was walking through a garden. He was carrying two white pigeons, and he stopped to pick up a beautiful flower, and he saw Nur Jahan, and he asked her to hold the pigeons. But after he picked the flower and he turned to her, she only had one pigeon. And he said, "How did that happen?" And she said, "Like this," and let the other one go. So that's the legend of their meeting. She was older than his other wives. I think she was his last wife. And really, she had a kind of a maternal relationship with him. She was able to control him by moderating his consumption of opium and wine. And in effect formed a kind of a junta with her brother and father. The Mughals did not have the practice of inheritance by the eldest son. That might sound good, but what it resulted in was really messy succession every time there was a change of rule, with usually armed conflict and so on. And so Nur Jahan favored one of her sons-in-laws. Her brother favored Jahangir's third son, Shah Jahan, who's the guy who built the Taj Mahal. Her brother won, and it shows that even for this very powerful woman, her power was still, to a degree, by proxy as the wife of Jahangir. And after he was gone, she was not able to compete with her brother. And she lived, as it said, in private and in sorrow, basically in house arrest, for the last almost 20 years of her life until her death in 1645.
Your chapter title, Witch Hunters and Truth Seekers, says a lot about what you explore in the section of the book on science, since part of what you show is that science wasn't yet separate from theology and astrology and alchemy and even the knowledge of witchcraft. You thread this all together by opening with an anecdote about Johannes Kepler, today heralded as one of the prophets of the so-called scientific revolution, but who in 1616 was worried about saving his mother from the accusation against her of witchcraft. Tell us a little bit about Kepler. Who was he? Why was he important? And how does his story teleport us back to the era of Galileo and the early modern trailblazers who ultimately redefined how science came about as we've come to understand it?
That's a very good kind of summary of what was going on. Kepler was a peculiar character, kind of prickly. He would be resentful, suspicious, deceitful, fawning. And I kind of like him. He was motivated by a search for beauty and divine harmony. His magnum opus was called The Harmony of the World. He thought that mathematics was the key to the universal harmony of God's creation. And Kepler was extraordinarily learned. His father was a mercenary. He came from humble beginnings. Kepler called his father vicious, inflexible, quarrelsome, and doomed. And he beat his wife and kids and eventually disappeared. So Kepler was raised by his mother. He wanted to be a professor of divinity. He ended up being a teacher of math in a little town in Austria. But he became an assistant to Tycho Brahe, the Dutch astronomer who had all this great data from a big observatory that he built in Denmark. And so he moved to Prague and worked with Tycho Brahe there. And he worked out the three laws of planetary motion. I won't tell you what they are. We'd be here all night. He did it all without calculus and without even decimals. It was extraordinary. You see his notebooks and they look like Joyce's Finnegan's Wake. I mean, it just all these calculations. So although Kepler was very learned, his mother, Katerina, who in 1616, she was in her 70s, she was illiterate and she was an herbalist and a healer. And what I found was that there were really two sort of lineages of knowledge at this time. After the Gutenberg Revolution in Europe, literacy spread more widely than it had been previously, but mainly among men. So you have this line of basically male literary knowledge. And then you have this folk knowledge, which Kepler's mother embodied, which was passed down orally from mother to daughter. So one of her herbal concoctions, you know, she was accused of witchcraft because of some like petty quarrel in the village where she lived. And she gave a woman an herbal infusion and the woman didn't get better. She got worse. And so she accused Kepler's mother of witchcraft. And then other people came out and said, yeah, you know, she walked by and our cattle and pigs died. And all these accusations came forward. Because of these two lines of knowledge, in my opinion, I think that's really what's behind the great burst of witchcraft trials at this time. There are about 50,000, 100,000 witchcraft trials in Europe between about 1550 and 1650, because the literate men in power were suspicious and fearful of this oral female tradition. If you go back to the Middle Ages, witches were not associated with any particular gender. There were male witches, female witches. But at this time, they nearly all were women. Kepler was able to get his mom off because he had powerful connections, but most of the women didn't have sons who were working closely with the emperor, and so they were not so fortunate. And Kepler, by the way, he was a devout Lutheran. He spent his last years doing astrological forecasts for the commander, the Catholic commander of forces in the 30 Years' War, which was the most devastating war in Europe until World War II. He contracted a fever and was raving and died and finally stopped talking altogether. He pointed to his head, he pointed to the sky, and then he passed away. And then the Swedes came in and dug up his grave and scattered the bones, and we don't know where they are.
I mean, in some senses, we could say with Kepler what you suggested, which is this was knowledge that was at a moment of tilting, because in a way, the mathematics behind modern science was only rising to a new level of supremacy, and theology was beginning to recede. And in some senses, it's similar in the sense that oftentimes these witch cases were taking place also at crossroads in areas that were on the margins between different places. It's all an index of the way in which the world really was in motion in 1616. That's not only the subtitle of your book, but it's also the title of your lost chapter. And in a way, that chapter rests on a real paradox, because on the one hand, most people in 1616 never really traveled very far away from their homes, more than 10 miles away. But on the other hand, you show that people are traveling all over the world in 1616. Just think, for example, about slaves or about missionary efforts, and you provide many, many other examples. You frame this story by talking about Pietro della Valle, who, I don't know if we could call him the first modern tourist, but why not? He's clearly an early world traveler. Why did you find his story so fascinating in particular in terms of what you wanted to explore about diasporism or the movement of people in the early modern world?
Pietro della Valle is another fascinating story. He spent 12 years traveling through the Muslim world. There were three great Muslim empires at this time, the Ottomans, the Persians, the Fafavid dynasty it was called, and the Mughals in India. And della Valle visited all of them. So his writings are some of the best that we have about the Muslim world at this time, at least from the perspective of a foreigner, of a Westerner. Also, because he traveled for such a long time, he encountered a lot of the other people that I talk about. So just from the standpoint of storytelling, he serves as a useful frame because I can work in a lot of these other stories. So he was an Italian nobleman. He had a 12-year love affair with a woman in Italy, and then she turned him down. He was despondent, suicidal, but rather than give himself up to suicide, he decided instead to become a pilgrim. And a lot of travelers at this time were pilgrims, and he called himself Pietro the Pilgrim. Other people called him Pietro the Fantastic, and we'll see why. And so he set off for the Holy Land, but he did so in kind of an indirect way. He went first to Istanbul. Pietro della Valle is a kind of an amusing and rather silly man, and something of a popinjay, and so he's always dressing up in these outrageous costumes everywhere he goes. And in Istanbul, he bedecks himself in silks and plumes and parades around as an Ottoman pasha. And then he goes from there to Cairo, and he visits the Sphinx, which was mostly under sand at the time. He climbs the pyramid. He carves his initials in the pyramid of Cheops. He discovers mummy and mummy paintings. He was the first to send them back to Europe, mummy paintings. And then from Cairo, he finally gets to Jerusalem, and he's been traveling now for 2 years at this time. And he sees all the holy sites. He gets himself a souvenir tattoo. And then he heads on to Aleppo in Syria. Now he's sporting a great bushy beard, which he brushes constantly in the Syrian style. And he's traveling on camel caravans through these caravanserai, that land trade network through this region. And he ends up in Baghdad. There he was traveling with two servants, and they got in a fight, and one of them killed the other one, and he had to dump the body into the Tigris, and he was worried because he was traveling under a false passport. He gets through that, and he meets this woman, Maani Giorida. She is a remarkable figure. She becomes his wife. She speaks like 7 or 8 different languages, so she helps him a lot in his travels. And then they decide to head to Persia, and they go to Isfahan, the Persian capital, to meet the Persian emperor, Shah Abbas. And now he cuts off his big bushy beard, and when his wife sees his clean-shaven face, she bursts into tears. He adopts this drooping mustache, which was the Persian style at the time. So he spends a year waiting for Shah Abbas to show up in Isfahan. He's meeting British and Spanish diplomats, and he even met, and this is extraordinary, he met a Japanese man passing through Isfahan on his way to Europe who taught him East Asian calligraphy. And I have no idea who that guy was or how he got there, but it just goes to show how people were moving around at this time. While they were in Isfahan, Maani and Pietro adopted an 8-year-old girl who was a war orphan. And with her, they decide to head off for Hormuz. But just as they get there, Maani dies. And Pietro decides that he doesn't want to bury her in this foreign land, which wasn't Christian. He wants to give her a Christian burial in a Christian country. So he preserves her corpse in camphor, puts it in a coffin, puts the coffin in a big trunk covered with clothing, and he sets sail for India with the daughter, whose name was Mariucha, disguised as a boy. He arrives in India. He ends up in Goa, which was the Portuguese port there. Adopts the Portuguese style of an upswept mustache and goatee. And he stays there for a couple of years, and all this time he's still got Mani's preserved corpse in this trunk. So after a few years, he heads back through Syria on a caravan, and he ends up back in Naples in 1626. So he was traveling for 12 years, and a lot of them he was carrying around his wife's corpse in this trunk. So he buries her in Italy, gives what he says was a beautiful speech, and we have 2 eyewitness accounts of it. One of them says that people were moved to tears, and the other one says that they all laughed. As I say, he was sort of a silly man. And then he ended up marrying the daughter. He married Mariucha, and together they had 14 sons, and some of the sons preserved his letters, which make up the story that has come down to us today of Pietro della Valle's travels through the Muslim lands. It's a remarkable story. And a lot of the people I write about, they're not the average people of the time. As you said, most people just didn't hardly travel to the next village. But there were these people, these extraordinary people who made these extraordinary travels, and it was happening more and more in the early modern world than in 1616.
And that's really what you end up showing us, is that In some ways, 1616 was the origins of our world. Thank you so much for being with us today on Counterpoint.
Thank you, Jonathan. It was a real pleasure.
Thomas Christensen will give an overview of his book, 1616, The World in Motion, at Rhodes College on April 21st at 6 p.m. It's the keynote lecture for a two-day celebration marking the 400th anniversary of Shakespeare's death, with a wonderful series of talks that are all free and open to the public, putting a spotlight on the role of scholars, academics, and intellectuals, and how their work illuminates the issues we face locally and globally. Counterpoint is a monthly broadcast on WKNO-FM. To listen to this show in its entirety, visit WKNOFM.org and click on the news menu item where you'll find a link to Counterpoint. You can podcast Counterpoint by visiting iTunes and searching for WKNO Counterpoint. Counterpoint is a production of WKNO-FM in association with the Spence L. Wilson Chair in Humanities at Rhodes College. Justin Willingham produces the show. I'm Jonathan Judakin. Thanks for listening.